The planet makes an orbit around the Sun in 225 Earth days, a Venusian year, yet it rotates around its axis in 243 Earth days, a Venusian day. And it rotates backward, clockwise as viewed from its north pole, while Earth and the other planets rotate counterclockwise. Venus's atmosphere is so thick that atmospheric pressure at ground level is equal to the pressure of an Earth ocean about a mile below the surface. That atmosphere is more than 95% carbon dioxide, with less than 4% nitrogen and only negligible traces of free oxygen. The thick layers of clouds that perpetually cover Venus from pole to pole reflect some 75% of the sunlight that hits the planet and make it very bright, beautiful to look at. The clouds, though, are made of sulfuric acid and other sulfur and chlorine compounds. There is practically no water vapor in them. There are mountains and volcanoes on Venus, and evidence of plate tectonics that have shifted vast sections of the crust. There must be Venus quakes as well. Imagine trying to walk on the surface of Venus. The very ground is red hot. The atmosphere is so thick that it warps light like a fisheye lens. The sky is perpetually clouded. Yet there is no real darkness. Even during the long Venusian night, there is an eerie, sullen glow from the red-hot ground. Because Venus is moving in its orbit around the Sun while it slowly rotates on its own axis, if you stood on one spot on the surface, it would take 117 Earth days from one sunrise to the next, if you could see the sunrise through those thick, all-pervading clouds. And the sun would rise in the west, set in the east. Looking up into the grayish-yellow clouds, you might see darker patches hurtling across the sky, forming and dissolving against the murky background nearly 50 kilometers overhead, scudding from horizon to horizon in about 5 hours. Now and then you might see a streak of lightning flashing down, or hear the threatening rumble of a distant volcano. No place in the inner solar system is so challenging, so dangerous. By comparison, the Moon is easy, and Mars a picnic. Could life exist on Venus, either high in the clouds where temperatures are cooler or deep underground? There is something in Venus's atmosphere that absorbs ultraviolet light. Planetary scientists are not certain of what it might be. Could there be bacterial forms that live underground, as there are on Earth and presumably on Mars and Jupiter's moon, Europa? If there are any creatures living on the surface, they must be capable of withstanding heat that melts aluminum and pressures that can crush spacecraft. Formidable monsters, indeed. Selene City.
"It should have been you, runt," he howled. "It should have been you who died, not Alex."
I awoke with a start, springing up to a sitting position in the darkened hotel room, both my fists gripping the bedsheets tightly enough to rip them. I was soaked with cold sweat and trembling from head to foot. The dream had been too real, too totally real. I squeezed my eyes shut, sitting there on the bed, and my father's enraged face burned before me like the wrath of some ancient god. The party at Hell Crater. His announcement of the Venus Prize. His notice that he was cutting me off without an income. It had all been too much for me. By the time I made it back to my hotel in Selene City, I was near collapse. The carpeted hotel corridors swimming dizzyingly, my legs weak as tissue paper, even in the low lunar gravity. I got to my room, went straight to the lavatory, and fumbled with my hypospray syringe. At last I injected a full dose of the enzyme medication into my arm, then tottered off to bed and fell almost instantly asleep, only to dream. No, it wasn't actually a dream. It was a reliving of that terrible day when we learned that Alex had been killed. A nightmare. I relived every agonizing moment of it. When we got the news that there was no possible hope left, Father had blanked his phone screen and turned to me, his face distorted with fury. "He's dead," my father had said, his voice cold and hollow, his gray eyes like ice. "Alex is dead and you're alive. First you killed your mother, and now you're still alive while Alex is dead." I just stood there while he glared at me, grim and bitterly angry. At me. At me.
It should have been you, runt,
he snarled, his fury mounting, his face going from white to red.
You're worthless. Nobody would miss you. But no, you're here. You're alive and breathing while Alex is dead. It should have been you, runt, he howled. It should have been you who died, not Alex.
That was when I moved out of the family home in Connecticut and bought my place on Mallorca, as far from father as I could get. Or so I thought. But he went me one better, of course, and moved to Cellini City. Now I sat in a hotel bed, shaking and cold with midnight sweat, alone, totally alone. I got up and padded barefoot to the lavatory. Tottered, actually, that's how weak and wretched I felt. The light went on automatically, and I fumbled with my hypospray syringe until I finally got a plastic cylinder, preloaded with the proper dosage of enzyme, clicked into place, and pressed it against my bare arm. The faint hiss of the medication, squeezing through the micro-needles and into my bloodstream, always reassured me. But not that night. Nothing could calm me, I thought. I was born with a rare form of pernicious anemia, a birth defect caused by my mother's drug addiction. It could be fatal if not controlled by injections of a cocktail of enzymes that included vitamin B12 and a growth hormone that prompted my body to create new red blood cells. Without that medication, I would weaken and eventually die. With it, I could lead a perfectly normal life, except for the need to take the injections at least twice a day. If anyone ever tells you that nanomachines could cure any medical condition, if only they weren't outlawed on Earth, don't believe him. The best labs at Cellini City, the capital of nanotechnology research, haven't been able to program a nanobug that can build millions of red blood cells every few hours. I went back to the bed with its tangled, sweaty sheets and waited for the medication to take effect. With nothing better to do, I called out for the video news. The wall screen immediately glowed to life and showed a scene of terrible devastation. Another raging hurricane had swung all the way across the Atlantic and was pounding the British Isles. Even the Thames Barrier, the high-tech dam across the river, had been overrun, and large sections of London were underwater, including Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament. I leaned back against my pillows and watched, hollow-eyed, as thousands of Londoners poured into the streets in the lashing cold rain to escape the rising floodwaters.
The worst cataclysm to hit London since the Blitz of World War II more than a century ago, the news announcer intoned in a crack-of-doom voice. Next channel, I called.
Death and destruction was not what I wanted to see, but most of the channels were showing London's agony, live and in full color. I could have watched it all in three dimensions if I'd called up the hologram channel. There were flotillas of boats chugging down the Strand and Fleet Street, rescuing men, women, children, even pets. Workers were struggling to protect Buckingham Palace from the encroaching waters. Finally, I found a channel that was not showing the flood. Instead, it had a panel discussion with self-proclaimed experts on the global warming that was causing such storms and flooding. One of them wore the green armband of the International Green Party. Another I recognized as a friend of my father's, a sharp-tongued corporate lawyer who clearly loathed the Greens. The rest were scientists of various stripe, no two of them agreeing on anything. I watched, glassy-eyed, hoping their quiet, mannered deliberation would lull me to sleep. As they spoke, the screen displayed animated maps that showed how the ice caps in Greenland and Antarctica were melting, and how much sea levels were expected to rise. Half the American Midwest was in danger of being turned into a huge inland sea. The Gulf Stream was going to break up, they said, freezing Britain and Europe into an extension of Siberia. Just the perfect lullaby to soothe me to sleep. I was about to turn the wall screen off altogether when the yellow message light began blinking. Who would be calling me at this time of night, I wondered. Answer, I called out. The entire wall screen turned a milky grayish-white. For a moment I thought there had been some malfunction of the video. Then a synthesized computer voice spoke to me. Mr. Humphreys, please excuse my not showing my face. It would be too dangerous for you to see me. Dangerous, I asked. For whom? The voice ignored my question, and I realized this was a pre-recorded message. We know you have heard the rumor that your brother's ship was sabotaged. We believe your father was responsible for his death. Your brother was murdered, sir, and your father is his murderer. The screen went dead. I sat there in the darkened hotel bedroom, stunned. shocked,